The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consul. I've got Jeff Dorman on the phone line with me. Welcome to the Dorman Report. Jeff, you've been on the road a lot this fall. In October, you were at Springboard in San Diego. Then you went to PREA in Chicago, followed by EDISA, which I attended with you, in Las Vegas. Then in November, you were at the ANREV and meeting in Singapore, then back to San Francisco for a trustees meeting with the Baylor REIT, then back to Kyoto, Japan for the Asia Pacific Publications Editorial Advisory Board meeting, then over to Hong Kong to meet with potential sponsors, and finally back to Chicago for the inaugural Board of Governors meeting for the institution, for the Institute for Real Estate Operating Companies. And the week after Thanksgiving, you'll be heading out to New York for a CEO summit, and the following week back to Hartford for a Hartford, Connecticut, for a meeting with one of our sponsors. A lot to cover. Let's start with Springboard. What is, for our listeners who aren't familiar with Springboard, what is Springboard all about and what happened there?
Well, Springboard's a program we've been doing. This is our fourth year of doing it. It's a program for people coming up in the business. So people probably in a mid-level who are moving through the management ranks and being promoted by their firms. And it's a development program. So in order to get invited to Springboard, you have to be nominated by a senior member of your firm. And if we limit the number of Springboarders that can come to 80, so it's a small, tight group. And we have a mix. So there will be a certain number of investor participants, there'll be a certain number of consultants, certain number of acquisition people, portfolio manager types, fundraising, marketing, client service types, cross the board, try to cover all angles so that people can cross-pollinate with each other, get to know each other, build a network, and get some education along the way. And it's a terrific program. This year, our keynote speaker was Lynn Thurber, who is still the chairman of LaSalle Investment Management and the big parent company. And she was just wonderful. You know, she provided the people there with a tremendous overview of her career and what got her, where she is today and the people that were helpful to her and how her whole career unfolded. It was really fascinating, and she's just a wonderful human being, and it was a terrific session. And then, we break down into mentor groups where different people from different disciplines. So there's an investor leader, I think it was John McClellan this year. The CIO group was headed by Glenn Lowenstein. We had people from Invesco. We had all kinds of different folks that were there working in small groups, basically answering questions that the Springboarders were putting to them about career development, secrets of the trade and those sorts of things. So it really is a very powerful little program.
So on to PREA, we don't want to make a presumption. Everybody knows what PREA is. What is PREA and what was going on in Chicago at that meeting?
Well, PREA is the Pension Real Estate Association. It was formed in the early 80s to really lobby for clarification of what at the time was called the plan asset rules, which was an outgrowth of ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. They had determined that if you were managing the assets of a pension plan, if you were managing what they call plan assets, then you were subject to certain restrictions. And so it was really important to understand who was managing plan assets and who wasn't, and to whom those restrictions apply. So that's how PREA was originally organized. And they were successful in getting clarification in the very early 80s of those rules. And then once that was accomplished, they changed their mission and changed their structure to be an educational organization. And it's become the place to go to meet, the place to go to get educated about what's going on in the real estate markets for pension funds and the people and companies that serve them. And at this year's PREA meeting, which was the fall meeting, which is always the investor council meeting, they had about almost 1,000 people, maybe 1,000 people there. So it was a big crowd of folks. And the keynotes were fantastic, including Michelle Obama. Beyond that, I really can't go into details because we're kind of sworn to secrecy. We're members of PREA, and we attend, but we don't attend as members of the press. And so we're not allowed to cover it. Understandably, when people are speaking at PREA from the podium, they don't want to be constrained by press coverage. So,
and then,
but it was a great show, and the energy of the group was really high, and it was just terrific.
You know, and then there is the ADESA meeting. It was in Las Vegas at the Aria Hotel and Resort and Casino, although we didn't do any gambling. Now, I should say that the ADESA stands for the Alternative and Direct Investment and Securities Association. It is a private wealth event. This really coincides with it's a partnership we have with our Real Assets Advisor magazine. This is the private wealth side of our business, Jeff. And quite recent, just in the last few years, this was your brainchild, the Real Assets Advisor magazine. And I think what you saw there was exactly why you started the magazine. The private wealth side of the business is just exploding with all this new wealth that's being created in the country and around the world, and also the movement that's being made among RIAs toward investing in real assets, kind of the endowment style model of investing, and investing in alternatives and more into alternatives and real assets. I thought the energy level there was terrific. You seemed pretty excited by what you saw. What's your thoughts on it?
Well, there's two things going on. One, as you mentioned, is there's a tremendous growing interest in the private wealth advisory marketplace amongst, you know, the broker-dealer community, amongst the, you know, Wall Street firms, and amongst the independent broker-dealers, as well as the registered investment advisors, which is probably the fastest-growing subsector of the wealth advisory market. A growing interest for alternatives, and there just isn't any good information resource for that, which is why we created Real Asset Advisor. But at the same time, the product side of the business is undergoing tremendous stress. The Department of Labor has introduced a fiduciary rule that basically says you have to put the interest of your clients first. We think that's a wonderful thing. We think it's great, and we're kind of puzzled why it's taken this long for somebody to come up with it. But it hasn't been without its controversies. They haven't really clarified what they mean by the rule. The rule hasn't gone into effect yet, and people are scrambling to try to understand what the implications of this are going to be. Also, some people are challenging DOL's, you know, authority even make a rule about this, since they really regulate pension plans, not necessarily investment advisors, who are typically, you know, regulated by the SEC. But the SEC supports the fiduciary rules, so there's been a lot of controversy over that. Meanwhile, over the last couple of years, there have been changes in the rules that require the sponsors of private programs to fully disclose the impact of front-end commission loads on individual investors' account balances, which, again, you would think would have been just obvious, but relatively new. And so this has made people much more aware of the fees, and they're becoming much more fee-averse as a result of this. And so consequently, there's been some pushback in that area. And then at the same time, they've also are increasingly requiring these portfolios to be marked to market, which is new. People used to be able to simply list them at cost or mark them up without any necessarily reconciliation to any valuation process. And so all of this is creating a lot of turmoil and stress in the market and, you know, adding additional cost to operating as well. So meanwhile, what's happening is, you know, traditional investment managers like Blackstone and TH Real Estate and Starwood and LaSalle and Deutsche Bank and others are beginning to provide products for this marketplace as well, which is pushing the bar up in terms of what you need to be able to deliver and how you need to compete in the marketplace, because many of these kinds of firms have track records that extend back you know, 20 to 30 years, and they're competing against firms that are relatively new and much smaller and don't have the resource base. So all of this is making the industry and the things that we have to write about it really fascinating. So it's an interesting thing, and there's lots of talk about that. And the keynote speaker there was George W. Bush, and he was tremendously charming and interesting to listen to. So it was really a fun, exciting meeting. And of course, interspersed, they had all sorts of different sessions, educational sessions for both product sponsors and for, you know, private wealth advisors to help educate them about the various alternatives that are available in the market, the regulatory climate, and all those sorts of things.
Now, you also traveled for a visit with the folks over at Baylard REIT, because you're a trustee of that organization. What is Baylard REIT? And am I even pronouncing its name correctly?
No, it's Baylard. It came out of a company that used to be called Baylard, Beeler and Kaiser. And the REIT has been around for a long time. A few years ago, actually before I got on the board, the existing board had made the decision that they were going to move away from kind of a fund-of-fund structure. The assets of the fund were being run by two outside advisors, Stockbridge and Invesco, and they decided they want to take it internally, mainly to reduce the cost to the investors of the REIT. And so in the middle of that process of transitioning that, one of the trustees retired, and I was nominated and elected to take his place. So for me, it's a wonderful thing because I get a chance to sit on the board, which also serves as the investment committee, and really understand the markets from the deal perspective and what's coming through their pipeline. And I've done this before. That was true when I was on Lexington Corporate Properties Trust Board, and also true when I was sitting on the J.P. Morgan Income and Growth Trust Board. So it's always fun to have one of these assignments because you know, a lot of what we deal with here at Institutional Real Estate is very top level, top down, and it's nice to get a bottom up perspective on what's going on in the market. And it's also, I think, an honor and a privilege to be able to serve because my job is really to represent the interests of the investors in the REIT, of which, of course, I am one. So it's been a fun assignment, but it did cause me to have to make a trip back from Singapore, where I had attended the ANREV meeting, to go to San Francisco and then turn around immediately and go back to Kyoto. So the travel schedule's been just crazy.
Well, and I was going to say then to Kyoto, Japan, and Land of the Rising Sun, a very spiritual city. And the editorial advisory board meeting for our Asia Pacific edition of the magazine was held. What were there? Who was at the meeting? What were some of the issues discussed? I mean, these board meetings, the institutional advisory, or the magazine board meetings, or editorial advisory boards, really bring the issues of the day to us. We rely on them a great deal. I know you always provide an explainer for this. What were some of the issues discussed, and what were some of the conclusions?
Well, let's talk about who was there first. We had 14 different investor representatives, executives from Aviva Investors, Bau Invest, two European investment institutions, two representatives from the Brunei Investment Agency, a representative from California State Teacher Retirement System, somebody from the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, somebody from Dai Nippon Inc. Pension Fund, which is a big corporate pension fund out of Japan, somebody from the Development Bank of Japan, somebody from Grosvenor Asia Pacific, which is, of course, the family office of the Duke of Westminster, somebody from Japan Post Bank, somebody from Mitsubishi Corp., Mitsubishi UFJ Lease and Finance Company, which is another subsidiary of the Mitsubishi family of companies, and then somebody from Nippon Life and somebody from Standard Charter Bank. So a really diverse group of investors representing several different countries around the world. Most of the people from other countries are actually, you know, officed and live in Asia and are representing them and handling their investments in Asia for the, you know, offshore fund. So if it's a European fund, that doesn't mean that they're traveling from Europe. A lot of times what they're doing is they're officing in Singapore or in Hong Kong or in Tokyo and then representing the interests of that fund or the Canadian fund or what have you in that region. And then, we also had our sponsors of the publication. And, those include the APREA, or the Asia Public Pacific Real Estate Association, CBRE Global Investors, Clarion Partners, Deutsche Asset Management, Green Oak Real Estate, Gresby, and Heitman. And in addition, also had a representative from the ANREV, which is another meeting I went to. ANREV is the Association of Non-Listed Real Estate Vehicles in Asia. And so we had the executive director from that organization there. So we had great industry support. We had the investor community there. We had the trade associations in the region there. And we had our sponsors there. It was a very productive meeting. So you're saying, you know, what topics did we talk about? Was that the next question?
Yeah, topics discussed. And also if there were any conclusions.
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear what people have to say and what's on their mind. One of the things that we're doing when we're preparing for this is we don't set the topics. The participants set the topics. And we just ask them, what's keeping you up at night? What are the biggest issues that you're facing? You know, what are the biggest challenges you're facing in managing your portfolios? And so topics range from monetary policy to interest rates to emerging market risk to currency risk to pricing to core and non-core to market timing to China to Australia to geopolitical risk to return expectations and changing return expectations both for GPs and LPs and to ESG and its impact on real estate investing. So all of those issues were things that we discussed over the course of the 2 days. Conclusions, I would say, is that for many, many years, you could look to Europe, which was very, very conservative in its outlook and the way in which it goes about allocating money and focusing on finding investments, to America, where it was a little bit more wide open, to, you know, Asia, where it was completely wide open. You know, typically in Asia, when you're talking about core investing, you're really talking about build to core and hold, because it's almost impossible because the core assets don't trade that much. So, and the population demographics have been driving growth so heavily that build to core has been kind of the primary strategy for implementing core investment strategies and creating core investment portfolios. And so, appetite for risk has always been much higher. This is the first time since we've been doing this, and we've been doing it for 10 years, that we sensed a kind of retrenchment and a more conservative pall settling in over Asia. I think at all of our board meetings this fall, all investors have been concerned about an eventual turnaround in the real estate markets. And none of them sense that there's any reason that fundamentals are driving us in that direction. Most of them seem to feel that, you know, the lending community has been pretty disciplined, and therefore there hasn't been this speculative development bubble that we've seen in other real estate cycles. What they're really worried about is they're worried about something disrupting the economic environment or hitting the equities market. And if there's a real significant downturn in the equities market, then everybody's going to kind of be frozen out of the capital markets because of denominator issues. So, you know, in other words, people all of a sudden becoming over-allocated to real estate or over-invested against their allocations to real estate because relative to their equity and bond portfolios, real estate's going to have a disproportionately larger share of the pie. And so this is the concern, the worry that something outside of their control is going to end this particular cycle. And also, I think people are concerned that this cycle has gone on for so long, and, you know, cycles don't go on forever. And given that this has been one of the longer cycles in the history of recent memory, even though it's not the only long cycle, they're just bracing for a change. And so that was a sentiment that I hadn't picked up in Asia before. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, my understanding is I think it's March. If growth continues to March in 2018, it will become the second longest recovery in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And that's it's been a tepid recovery, and that's what a lot of people have complained about. And maybe that's why it's been so elongated. But as we all know, eventually there will be a downturn. And after the last one we had that was so severe, I think people are a bit worried that we'll see that same kind of really kind of devastating downturn. But hopefully not. We will certainly be optimistic in the meantime. Now, you also went over to Hong Kong where you had a meeting. Who were you meeting with?
Well, I was meeting with a company called Phoenix Property Investors. Pretty interesting little company. They're an Asia-based, Asian-run company out of Hong Kong. People involved in it came out of investment banking originally, but both of them kind of grew up in a real estate environment, you know, real estate families. Come from some of the dominant real estate families in Hong Kong, even though what they've built in their own company has really been based on their own efforts and not through their families. They've got, as I mentioned, they've got about $6 billion under management, really a three-pronged strategy. They tend to focus on opportunistic investing, where they've done fairly well, also on what you might call enhanced core or core value type properties, and they also have a mezz debt lending platform, and they all kind of work together in a synergistic way to kind of help each other. So it's a really interesting little company. And one of the things that really struck me is, you know, when we were talking, is that they were telling me that their concern is that they've got far too many deals for the number of dollars they have available at their disposal to spend. And boy, I got to tell you, that's the first time I've heard that anywhere on this planet. But I, you know, and I question them deeply about it, because, you know, most people are telling us that they're having difficulty accessing deals. Their claim is that, you know, they've been living and operating in these markets. They grew up in these markets. They know these markets backwards and forwards. And so they're able to access deals that sometimes other people just aren't able to access because they're not as present in the markets. You know, I'm not here to judge, you know, the value of that one way or the other, but I thought it was a pretty interesting thing, because I haven't heard that from anybody for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So finally, you came back to town from Chicago, and in Chicago, there was the Board of Governors meeting for the IREOC, which I said at the top is the Institute for Real Estate Operating Companies. What was that all about, Jeff? This was the first meeting of that Board of Governors. How did it go? What was it about?
Well, you know, as we have talked about, I think, on prior podcasts, the Institute of Real Estate Operating Companies is a club that we've put together. It's a membership organization that is designed to help investors, investment managers, and real estate operating companies that want to form joint ventures, form more profitable, more productive, more effective, more efficient joint venture. And the purpose of it is to do networking. The purpose of it is to develop educational programs to help each side understand each other better. So to help investors understand the operator and the operator's point of view, and to help the operators understand investment managers and the investors' point of view, and understand the worlds in which they have to operate and the demands that are placed on them, so that they can be in better position to be able to be more responsive and more helpful to them. And the purpose of the Board of Governors is to serve as the governing body for the organization. And this was an organizing meeting, so a lot of what the meeting was all about was, you know, setting up the roles that the board is going to play and getting some agreement on what the priorities of the organization are going to be. And the conclusions that we came to really come down to the first mission really needs to be building the membership and carefully crafting the membership so that we don't overload the investors and investment managers with too many of the same kinds of operators. What they're looking for is a mix of different kinds of operators that can meet a broad range of needs. And from the operator's perspective, they don't want to see too many operators because they don't want to create a too crowded field. So it really is going to be a very exclusive group. Another thing that they were concerned about is, how do they go about vetting members, potential members? You know, should there be some minimum qualifications for membership in the organization on the operator side? And there was a lot of diverse opinion about that, and I'm not sure we came to a final conclusion about it. I think the only thing we did conclude is there probably will be some kind of vetting, because it's silly to put people into the organization that really couldn't, in effect, partner with the capital providers, the investment managers or the investors. But it's not going to be a thing where we're going to be sitting there judging the efficiency of it. I think it's going to be more like the membership determining whether or not they think there's a fit or not. So, again, the issue is still subject to further discussion until we come to a final conclusion, but that's something that we're working on. The third thing we worked on is the educational mission and what kind of educational programs do people want to see us develop. And it was a pretty robust discussion about that. And we focused on, you know, perhaps some case studies of successful joint ventures that have been formed and how those originally those relationships were formed and how they were how the operator approached the investor or investment manager or how the investment manager or the investor found the operator to begin with and how the organization opened up and how they went about negotiating it and what kind of structure they finally resulted in and what kind of projects did they end up doing and what kind of results were produced and how satisfied was everybody with the type of arrangement. So that's one of the things people would like to see. And then I think, you know, some of the operators would like to understand, you know, how things work behind the curtain. What is the language and culture of the institutional market? And what are the terminology that they use? And what does all that language mean? And how should they be interacting and interfacing with people? And how can they add value to the whole process? And then, of course, on the investor and investment manager side, it's like, how can we understand the more granular nature of what an operator does on a day-to-day basis? You know, how can we kind of figure out what the day in the life of Ivanovich is? And so, you know, again, things like that, we went on for quite a while. There was a lot more to it, and I don't want to get through all the details, but it was a really productive meeting. And then the final thing that we talked about were standards. And I think what we came to the conclusion is that the organization itself really will see itself as being a promulgator of existing standards, like the NCREIF and PREA, you know, real estate information standards, and other standards that are being promulgated and trying to get to through the international organizations like NREV and ANREV and others, to try to be a clearinghouse of those. The whole idea is we're not trying to change the world and we're not trying to impose standards. We're trying to offer to the operators the opportunity to understand the standards that their investment managers and their investors are trying to operate by so that they can be more in compliance with those things at the ground up granular level, so there isn't so much re-massaging of that information that needs to be done. I think the Board of Governors concluded that while that's all well and good, that's not something they at the board level want to be intimately engaged with, that if we're going to get involved in setting some of those kind of things, that we need to really get into more of their, the more granular we get, the more the back office people that really handle and deal with these things need to get involved in it. So that's something we took into consideration as well. There's also an opportunity for the Institute to eventually develop standards that really pertain specifically to helping run real estate operating partnerships more effectively and more efficiently. And again, we're not going to be sitting there enforcing these in any way, shape, or form. Simply letting people know, maybe even standards isn't the right word. The right word might be guidelines that people can follow in terms of best practices to make it easier to smooth and remove the friction out of the relationship between the multiple layers. Because typically you've got information flowing from an operator up to an investment manager, eventually to an investor, and then back down again. So that can be really rough if there's a lot of interpretation or translation that needs to be done in the process. If we can get everybody speaking the same language, so to speak, then all of a sudden the need for translation becomes less, things operate more efficiently, information flows faster, and everybody can rely on the information that's flowing a lot better. So that's what we're looking to hope to be able to do.
So you're back in town now, but really not for long, because as I said, after Thanksgiving, you're going to be heading off to New York City to preside over the CEO Summit. What is that all about, Jeff?
Well, this is a group that we put together as an alternative to some of the other CEO summits that are ongoing in the industry, and that serve a wonderful purpose and do great things. We're not in any way criticizing them. But what happens a lot of times is these organizations start, these groups start, with the idea that they're going to create a forum that allows CEOs to kind of cross-pollinate and talk to each other. But as they grow and get more and more people involved, the ability to actually have conversations diminishes and they start to turn into just mini programs. So, you know, the program gets filled with lots of speakers, lots of panel discussions, but there isn't as much opportunity for the talking, just sitting down and talking to each other about issues. So we created a CEO summit for a smaller group of people. It's not for the industry. It's for the members of the firms that sponsor our our publications. And given the conflicts that people have with their schedules and what have you, we realized that from the very beginning, by definition, that would make it a much smaller group. So we're typically going to have somewhere between 10 to 15 to 20 people. This year we're going to have 15 people coming. And so it's more like a YPO style gathering where people sit around a table and have a chance to really talk about some important issues that are, you know, that they need to be concerned about, really thinking at the strategic level. You know, I would say that if you thought about it, you know, most CEOs know that their job is to think strategically, and they do spend a lot of time doing that. But they also, you know, get distracted all the time from just the daily demands of their job. And this is an opportunity for them to step back, gain some needed perspective, to think strategically about the business and their clients, and also to network and exchange ideas and share viewpoints with their peers. So it really is a wonderful opportunity to take a break once a year. It doesn't happen all the time. It just happens once a year, usually right around Christmas time. It's a pretty efficient thing. You come in for dinner and cocktails the night before, you network and have round tables until around 4 o'clock the next day, and then you're out. So it's a very efficient use of time. And it's facilitated, so we don't allow any one speaker to dominate the conversation. We try to keep everybody engaged and everybody involved, and we have lots of different exercises that we get people involved in to get them talking to each other and really getting to know each other.
And finally, you'll still be on the Eastern Seaboard. At least this one's a short hop. You're going to Hartford, Connecticut. When I think of Hartford, I think of insurance companies. Who are you meeting with? Are you meeting with one of the big insurers?
No, not at all. We're meeting with UBS. Now, UBS spun out of Allegis, which spun out of Aetna. So at one time they were insurers, and that's probably why they're in Hartford. But it's UBS. It's part of United Bank of Switzerland's investment management, global investment management platform, and they're the real estate arm of it. And they've been sponsors of our publications for years and years and years. And like a lot of our sponsors, they frequently call in me or call in Jonathan to spend some time with their people, just to kind of compare notes, you know. So they'll have us meet with, you know, their marketing group. They'll have us meet with their acquisitions group. They'll have us meet with different parts of it. And it's really more of a dialogue than, you know, a presentation. You know, we share what we're seeing going on in our side of the world from our perspective. They share what they see going on in their world and with the activity that they're facing and the challenges they're facing. And so we just get to know our clients on a much deeper level. And we both gain from the exchanged intelligence. So we always find these to be tremendously stimulating and interesting part of the work that we do.
So that's the whirlwind tour you've been on, past and future, never ending, of course. That pretty much wraps it up. Thanks for your time, boss.
Right, Mike. Thanks.